What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 119, Advanced Physical Therapy with Ryan Collins, recorded November 19th, 2014. Our guest this week is Ryan Collins. He was with us at the Sports Medicine Update in June, so that was episode 89, and I have that referred to in the show notes, but I wanted to come back and talk to him a little bit more about some of the stuff that he was talking about, and then we also have Brad Brown back with us again, and so he enjoyed it so much he said he had to come back this week. We also have Nicole Kasha and Brett Siders.
Yes.
Brett Siders from representing the University of Houston Masters of Athletic Training Program. Dr. Knobloch is at home with his sick daughter, so I told him to stay home and be a hero to his daughter instead of being here with me. So I am your host, Jeremy Jackson. Sitting right next to me is
Jose.
Shakira.
Gabby.
And then
Olivia.
Jess.
And so we got all the rest of the sports medicine students, and I am actually here for the first time in a couple days because on Thursday we had our third son, so he is less than a week old.
Congratulations.
Yep, so Thursday Congrats. Night, yeah, it's exciting, it's fun. I'm tired, I'm pretty
well,
sleepy.
Course.
I was up about
That's
4.
You deserve.
Yeah, well, you know, I know what happens when I do that. So, but anyways, I'm excited, and I think my wife and boys are probably watching at the house, so if you are, hi. So if you want to join the conversation at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, you can register there for the CEUs. You can use hashtag TheSMB on Twitter, and I think Matthew's on Twitter. You can find that. Ustream social feature is where Bernice can find you, and links to those are on the website. I think that's about it. Bob hopefully has some questions for Ryan because he is intending to go to A&M to do physical therapy school, or go to A&M and then go physical therapy after that. So, Bob, I want you to know that if you weren't interested in physical therapy, I would have rescheduled with Ryan. I would have rescheduled it, but I knew that you wanted to do this, and I wanted to make sure you have a chance to go through all this. And so I would have rescheduled it because I'm out on sick leave until after Thanksgiving. So take advantage of this opportunity. This is especially for you. Okay? All right. So, Jose, why don't you get us started?
Mr. Collins, tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Ryan. I'm a physical therapist with Memorial Hermann. I've been working with them for about 5 years now. Work out in Pearland by 288-518. Physical therapist. We at our clinic we see all kinds of patients. We have our young patients just coming in from injuries, playing sports. We have middle-aged parents coming in from back injuries and when they go on vacation and hurting themselves. And then we have your older population with knee replacements and joint replacements. So we see the whole gamut of the patient population in physical therapy.
All right. So since we are kind of focusing this on Bob for just a little bit, where did you go to school for undergrad and then for physical therapy school?
I went to Sam Houston for 4 years, got my degree in kinesiology, and then didn't really know what I wanted to do. I thought I was going to coach baseball, but realized that not every school wanted just a baseball coach, and I didn't want to do anything but baseball. So spent 2 years as a PT tech. My dad went through physical therapy, so he was pushing me to try that out. So I spent 2 years just as a tech, working in a clinic, doing exercises. I've enjoyed exercise and activity, so I knew I wanted to do something with sports. And when I realized I wanted to do that, so I applied to UTMB in Galveston, got in, and spent 2.5 years of studying and studying and studying, and got out, and here I am.
All right. Do you have a specialization in the athletic population or anything like that? Because I know you've talked twice at the Sports Medicine Update by right. Memorial Hermann.
Right.
And so obviously there's a reason they bring you in. Do you have any sort of specialization or anything like that?
Yeah, I'm currently certified as a strength and conditioning specialist. I'm a CSCS, and that's something I did on my own just because of my love for sport. And I figured that if I'm going to work with a specific clientele, a specific population in sports, I should probably do my best to know as much about exercise and strengthening that I could. And then I'm currently studying to take the SCS, which is an APTA certified certification for certified. It's basically a sports certification specialist. Take that test in March. So, everybody, good luck. Give me good luck for that.
All right. Well, good luck. So, Bob, do you know what APT is? It's The Association of Physical Therapists?
Yeah, American Physical Therapy Association. Okay. So basically it's the governing body for all physical therapists, kind of tells us what to do and helps us out.
And that's APTA.org or, you know?
Yeah.
All right, so somebody looked that up over there, some pull up on your phone or something like that, APTA. So that's going to be the go-to spot to find out for physical therapy schools where you would want to go. So.
Right.
Okay. Any more questions about Ryan and his background, physical therapy? You found it? What is it? .org. Okay, so APTA.org. So if you're interested in physical therapy, hopefully you know that, but Bob would be able to look that up. All right. And then, you know, Brad, I'm excited to have you here because obviously you have a lot of experience with doing rehab with 27 years in the NFL, right? 27? And then, you know, your college experience as well. So please feel free to jump in and give us your comments there. So
yeah, I think, you know, I'd jump in right now. My background, again, is, you know, came out of the NFL. I think for people that are interested in physical therapy, I think what you're seeing a real trend in sports medicine and professional ranks specifically, but you're starting to see it a lot in colleges where you're actually having a physical therapist hired by the universities to do their rehab or really emphasis on their rehab. You're seeing some dual credentialed. We were where I was. We've had a dual credentialed physical therapist, athlete trainer for close to 20 years, and they were primarily responsible for handling our rehab. But they were also an athlete trainer. They had their certification as an athlete trainer as well, so they could carry over. It was a good carryover. But I think what you're seeing in that profession is that there's a lot of opportunities there now, and it's that field is really opening up. Where Ryan, you know, has said he's getting a sports-specific aspect of it, you're starting to see a lot more of that, and you're, you know, part of the requirements in some of these schools are that you have that, or that you get that specific sports-specific area that you have. But I think that you know, you're seeing a lot of carryover there. So from the athletic training side and the sports medicine, physical therapy side, you're starting to see a lot more carryover. They're working hand in hand. And I think, you know, from our standpoint, we're both obviously with Memorial Hermann, and, you know, we're really exploring opportunities here where we're looking at getting into some places where, you know, we're not only trying to do the rehab part of it, but maybe finish it, you know, as Ryan was saying with the CSCS, finishing up some of that process so that if we take a person that's just starting his rehab process, the therapist will take him through all the you know, the early rehab, but when they start doing that transition back to on the field stuff and getting back to play, we feel like that's an area that we can really start working on. And that's kind of what we're actually talking about, several things with that part of it, and our performance team with our Ironman sports medicine clinics, and trying to look into some things like that you know, maybe we can expand that a little bit.
Sounds good. And I think that's exactly what we're wanting to kind of talk about, is the late stage or the advanced rehab. So very cool. I had a question. Oh, I was going to say, yeah, whenever I did my internship with the Texans, I know Tom Colt was a physical therapist and athletic trainer. And then so I was looking into physical therapy school. And for me, I did internship or observation hours with Tier Physical Therapy Clinic. And, you know, I realized that I'm sitting in an office all day, or, you know, I'm just kind of standing around. And again, maybe it was just because I was just a intern, I was getting heat pads and just standing. It's like physical therapy is just not what I want to do. You know, athletic training is really what I want to do. But then I was like, well, maybe it'll help me if I want to work in the NFL, do physical therapy and the athletic training. And, you know, ended up not working out. And I decided just to go with the athletic training. And, you know, that's why I always tell people, do internships where you want to go, because sometimes it's just not what you think. And even with my internship with the NFL, I'm glad that I did that. Instead of chasing it throughout my whole life, I was like, well, you know, it was really really fun, really cool experience, but it's a lot more work than I thought. I mean, you know, just as I was just thinking, oh, hey, they only have 16 games, they only work half a year. No, during the preseason, what it's called, training camps, it's 100 hours a week. Yeah. I mean, you wake up, you go straight there, you eat breakfast there, you're doing treatments, you're doing practice, you're going to bed at 11 o'clock, so, you know, 6 to 11 every day for 4 weeks. And then it just doesn't stop, you know. So the internships are definitely invaluable. So.
They are, and you know, but again, I think that I think that as you see, and I'm sure these guys that are in physical therapy school will tell you, you know, a lot of their hours that they put in is, you know, clinical hours, and they, you know, the things may not be as fun as you. And I was kind of the same way. I was really, when I went to school, I really was going to go pre-physical therapy. I got introduced to athletic training, and that's the way I went. If I had to do it today, though, I think that I would really, you know, steer some students to, you know, if they're really interested in the therapy side of it, to get that in part, that part of it. And then, to, you know, if you could work the athletic training side into it as well, I mean, that's a great dual credential. But you do have to understand it. It does take a little extra work because the way both the curriculums are set up now, it's hard to do them together. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to kind of get one side and then come back into the other side.
And there aren't many schools that offer the dual credentialing.
Correct. You got to, yeah. I know one of the guys that you worked with as well, or that, you know, that I worked with went to the University of Wisconsin. He was able to get his physical therapy through there, and then work as an athletic trainer at the same time. Got through their program in that sense. So it kind of works. So you just have to kind of see where the programs are. I think that's a good thing about some of these master's athletic training programs now, though, is that you can get your PT degree, and then you go back into these master's programs, get some hours. In fact, I had a guy working for me last year that had done that. He went to the A&M, or he got his physical therapy, and then last year he was in the A&M. The last couple of years he did the A&M master's program in athletic training, and was so then he got his dual certification.
All right. Do you have any questions about PT school? What you got?
So what's the difference between athletic training and physical therapy?
Well, I'll say athletic training, what we probably are most known for is on-the-field care. So I'm going to be the one that sees the injury first. So whenever, you know, that kid goes down on the sidelines, breaks his ankle, I'm going to be the one that takes care of him, gets him to the hospital, and then he's going to go to the doctor, and then he's going to see Ryan, the physical therapist, and Ryan's going to help him do the rehab to make him stronger, and then he's going to send him back to me and return him to play. So Ryan can actually return him to play. He knows he has the skills to do that, but usually because he works in a clinic and I'm working at the school, and because of insurance and stuff like that, he's the one that's going to do a good bit of the early and basic strength stuff. And then from there, I'm going to be the one doing the beginning and the end of the process, just the way it would work here. So in the NFL, it's different because he's involved, you know, he's involved in the whole process. But does that seem fair enough?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on the location that you have, like you were mentioning, the facilities. You know, some of these Ironman clinics, they have facilities that are expanded so that you can get that return to play aspect involved in the PT in the PT area. But typically, if you think about it like this, you get injured. Athletic training gets you to the physical therapist after the doctor. That's the initial injury. The physical therapist then allows you to go back to playing sports, but you can't go back to sports until you've gone through your athletic trainers preparing you for those skills. So, I mean, there's a clearance for the doctor to get you to the therapist. Then the therapist clears you to go back to the school, and then the trainers take you from there. So in the gamut of healthcare, you know, there's all members of it that are working together. But there's different stages that each member kind of falls into.
Well, in the collegiate level, they may not even see a physical therapist. They might go through the therapy and rehab with the athletic trainer post-acute injury. So it all depends also.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's where I think that you're starting to see this carry over a little bit. In other words, that's where I see, you know, like in the university setting, I know that they have a therapist over at U of H, right, mm-hmm. that works in their training room as well. So, again, that's kind of the settings that you're starting to see a little bit more in the athletic field, is that you're starting to see a little bit of carryover into the physical therapists are taken out of their typical physical therapy realm in a hospital setting or a clinic, put into a training room setting where it's kind of integrated in so that you're seeing a lot more of all the things that are going on. Not only are you working the therapy at the start, but you're actually helping carry that all the way through. And our therapist, in fact, was really in charge. We had him and helped him learn that finishing process too, as far as getting those guys back out on the field. And when I left, he was really in charge of the rehab process from the very start all the way through finishing them out and making sure they were ready to go back on the field, were in condition and could run and do all the proper things that they had to do. That was really his job. I mean, that's kind of where we had labeled that down. So I think that it's a very open field from that standpoint, that you can, you know, I think that that's an area that I say, from if people are really interested in the athletic training side of it or sports medicine side of it, then that's a good way to kind of integrate both those in there.
I have a question. Would you perceive a healthcare provider in the sports medicine field, if they went to physical therapy school and specialized in sports medicine, compared to if they went to physical therapy school and they were an athletic trainer and got their ATC?
I'm taking it from the athletic trainer side of it. And something that I think was important, and I don't want this, it's not degrading by any means to physical therapy. I think that what you look at in athletic training, there's a lot of different entities to athletic training that we see, and it's the multitasking and things that you have to do on a regular basis that are very, very almost what I'd say scattered compared to a clinical setting where right. you have a strict, you know, you have certain time limits and you put guys in and you have patients come in and so on and so forth. I think that, so there's an adjustment period for, if a physical therapist has never been in a training room setting, then it's tough for them to kind of adjust to that. If they've been in a clinical setting for a long time and it's a very routine and very structured, then to go into an athletic training setting where it's very kind of helter-skelter is different. I mean, it's just a different setting. And so you have to kind of learn how to change your speeds and be able to adjust. Because if you look at a typical athletic training room, you may have your athletes in there for an hour. So you may have 25 people in there for an hour, and then you're done. So, you know, of course, in a professional setting, it's a little bit longer than that. You have different times, but you have to kind of adjust that a little bit. So when I was always looking for physical therapy athletic trainers, one of my questions was he an athletic trainer first or physical therapy first? Mm-hmm. And had he worked in an athletic training setting, or did he go to PT school first and then kind of work back in? Because some of that practical skills and that you see in an athletic training room are just a little bit different. And that's where I think where we are with our sports performance people and at Memorial Hermann is that we're trying to integrate all these different aspects into kind of some of these things so that it is a true team approach where we have our physical therapists, we have our sports performance people, we have our physiology of exercise people that kind of do some of the testing for us. And then we have our strength and conditioning coaches that are actually that team kind of has formed together to kind of do some of this sports performance stuff and help kind of carry that out. And that's kind of where we're headed with this.
Yeah, we like to describe it as organized chaos in the training room sometimes.
Right, right.
It's different than that.
As you guys have seen, you know, you'll go into the training room there and there'll be guys all in the hallway and all this stuff. And so, you know, again, I love talking with like Ryan or other physical therapists because it makes my job of rehab better. And that's, you know, there's a lot of things when I went to the Saturday injury clinic and I said, hey, Ryan, I got some kids with this problem. What are you going to do? So there he shows me. So I don't think one of them is better than the other. They're just different and in a lot of ways similar. So we're, again, same goal is returning the patient to normal life. So answer your question. Yes, yes. All right, anybody else? Any other questions like that? Bob, anything? Come up with anything yet? You're just taking it all in?
Yeah, I'm just
I think Bob's a little embarrassed. I think his cheeks are red. Okay. All right, so then we'll get to some of the advanced physical therapy stuff that we wanted to talk about. And again, I talked to Ryan at the Sports Medicine Update, or actually I think Dr. Yellen and Bill talked to Ryan, and it was episode 89. So if you want to go back, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, episode 89, there's his PowerPoint that was in there. It has all the videos and the stuff that he talked about in there. So if he references something like that, it's episode 89 on the Sports Medicine Broadcast, and the links to that are in the show notes. Again, there's videos and his PowerPoint, but that's not what we're going over today. Exactly. We're just going to kind of go off whatever he comes up with. So
what is late stage ankle rehab?
What is late-stage ankle rehab?
Right. So typically, here's what happens is on Tuesday, we'll set up and practice, and we'll go over the questions, and I'll explain them. Well, yesterday I was not here, so we couldn't practice. Actually, I haven't been here since Thursday.
Okay.
And so we're a little bit off our game because the baby. So what I really want to know is give me some examples or some things I can do for late-stage ankle rehab. I've got a girl in there, a freshman. She's playing JV basketball, hurt her ankle, and it's continuing to hurt, but she's playing. So what are some things that I can do to push her past? I know obviously she needs to take rest.
Right. So, you know, if swelling's down and they're able to walk and they have normal mobility, what you're looking at with an ankle, ankles are a mobility joint. They're supposed to be mobile. And what you want to have with an ankle, especially within a sport context, is controlled mobility. So if you have a loose ankle that's going to roll one way or the other, you're going to continue to aggravate or lead to further injuries. So what you have to really focus on is controlled mobility. And if you put it in the context of sport, whenever you plant, whenever you cut, when you jump and you land, your foot and your ankle are the first thing that typically hit the ground. And if you have a loose joint there, the rest of your kinetic chain has pretty much lost its force, lost its ability to do what your plan was. So late stage ankle rehab, if you're going into more predominant strengthening exercises that are unilateral, so one leg on the ground, other foot on a bench or off the ground, doing a lot of single leg strengthening exercises where you're holding weights in the opposite hand, putting stress to that injured leg, keeps your body engine working on keeping your body under control. So you know, the basic, if you're going to go through a strengthening program, focus on the unilateral strengthening side of it. But then also agility and landing mechanics. You look at how the foot responds to hitting the ground. Do you have the proper mechanics where is your knee going too far forward over your toes, which is going to lead to a knee injury because you've lost the ability to dorsiflex or pull your toes towards your shin. Then you want to focus on them retraining that proper landing mechanic so when they come down, they don't injure some other area because they're worried about their current injury in the ankle. So you go through landing mechanics. What you want to see with late stage ankle rehab is normal, basically return to normal mobility, normal function, where they look like they're not limping around. So if she's in pain, is the pain just due to weakness where she's not able to tolerate the duration of activity? So an endurance type thing. Does she land and then try and hop off the foot so she doesn't trust herself to put pressure on that foot? You know, what you kind of have to do is take a really good history from the patient and ask them, what is it that's not feeling right? What do you not feel like you're doing the way you were before you're injured? And so looking at that, it always comes down to how the patient feels. So, I mean, you got stability, you got to be able to control your mobility, and then all the aspects of...
Yeah, one thing we always, you know, too, in rehab, and I think this is what's critical to rehab or what you really want to do with your rehab is you always have to challenge them a little bit. In other words, part of it is you're wanting to challenge. You'd be surprised how, especially the more advanced your athletes are, how easy it is for them to do some of this stuff that doesn't necessarily, you know, they'll pick up the basic stuff pretty easy, but then it gets, you know, so you want to find things to challenge them, and something that I always enjoy doing with them was we would try to come up with some kind of a game or something where, you know, they would have to play a game and try to beat somebody or because, you know, athletes are pretty competitive anyway. So they like to, you know, they like to compete and get after each other a little bit and see who can win. And even if it's a balance, if it's a one leg balance on a BAPS or, just a balance sponge and see, you know, I mean, make them go for 30 seconds and see who can do it the longest. Or see who puts how many times they put their foot down, or something like that. You know, just working little games like that seems it's a good challenge for them.
What are your thoughts on unstable surface versus regular surface training?
I think that, I think it kind of depends on where you're working too, and what kind of sport you're working with. If it's an outdoor sport, you work in football, you're going to have an uneven surface. You know, if you work in basketball, it's a little more stable floor. So, but I think that I guess my basic understanding of soft versus a hard surface is kind of a progression that you start on the hard surface and start on a flat floor or no extra things on the floor first. See if you can balance on the floor first and then start working your way up. And that even includes, and I know there's a little bit of mixed research on this, but I was always taught as well to, you're more unstable out of a shoe versus in a shoe. So part of that progression, if you're working on the ankle, is, you know, if you want somebody to be more stable, put them in the shoe. And then as you want to, you know, try to increase that instability, like on a balance pad or something, take them out of the shoe. And now they're having to, you know, do that. I had the chance to work with some really good athletes, and you know, you couldn't knock them off the sponge, but they'd squeeze the sponge so hard with their toes just so they wouldn't fall off. You know, I mean, it was always a challenge. You had to kind of always work things like that.
Challenging their proprioceptors. What I've seen is with ankle instability, you really want to assess the biomechanics of the entire leg and also strength. So if you are challenging balance with an ankle, maybe strengthening like glute med so that they're able to down the kinetic chain or up the kinetic chain, kind of keep that stability and help the ankle.
All right. So you're talking about the competition. Have y'all ever used an Xbox or anything like that? Because we have an Xbox Kinect here, and we got it as part of a grant to help to do rehab. But I've really been struggling to apply that because, you know, I'm thinking I don't want kids hopping and bouncing around because they're trying to win a competition, but then they're doing form poorly. And so at what point would I possibly incorporate that? Would it be like they're ready to return to play or about to return, and we're trying to get them into, you know, the normal gameplay movement? Do you have any idea what the Xbox Kinect is?
Yes.
Okay.
See, he's younger than I do. He knows.
In that regard, I would say have them practice the act and the task outside of the competition of the game so they can perfect their mechanics, and then say, all right, with those same mechanics, let's challenge you that way. I mean, you don't want to send somebody into a competitive environment when they haven't shown that they can demonstrate proper mechanics.
So, you know, a lot of them will be doing like squat jumps. So just make sure that they can squat first and then they can jump, you know, do squat jumps. And then
do the squat jumps outside of the competitive environment, away from the Xbox, you know, in front of a mirror, have some verbal, you know, some verbal cueing, some external feedback so that when they see they can do it and you can say, all right, you've done this, looks good. Now let's challenge you. And then
go ahead. What I was going to say is, I don't think that, you know, as an athletic trainer or physical therapist, you ever want to lose track of your progressions. I think it's important to work through your progressions. You know, it starts very simple and works up, and you make it harder as you go, but you don't want to overdo it. I mean, you don't want to jump from doing a single leg, just a balance, you know, static balance, to jumping over things. I mean, there's a progression that you want to take. You know, as far as your, you know, your competitions, what I would do is, you know, practice with them, get them to where they can do it. You work with them a little bit when they feel like they're getting pretty good at it, then challenge them, in other words, take them to the next step. So don't ever forget your progressions. I mean, I think it's important that's a big part of that rehab process is knowing your progressions and, you know, keeping that in mind as you advance those athletes.
All right. So you talked some about single leg exercises, but like I said, so I got the girl, she's in there playing, and I haven't taken a good history because, like I said, I have been kind of absent. So I think she got hurt but she came out of the game on Tuesday because her ankle was hurting. And I was, I've been gone pretty much all day Thursday and forward. And so I haven't been had a chance to talk to her to see what's wrong. She was in there just now before we started this, saying, you know, it hurts a little bit. And so what am I going to be looking for to help assess exactly what her need is there? What do you think, Ryan?
Well, first I'd ask her where her pain is. You know, when she's getting bothered by the activity, I mean, there's so many activities and so many movements that go along in sport, you can't narrow down to one, but you can say, where's your pain? And if it's, below your on the lateral side of your ankle, below your malleolus, and you're thinking maybe it was a lateral ankle sprain, you know, she's back in, she's been cleared from the doctor to return to play, so obviously it's not anything that needs surgery. You say, okay, when does it hurt? Is it when you land? Is it when you jump? Is it when you cut? And then kind of just narrow down the activities. If it's all the time, then you're probably looking at an unstable ankle, and then that's when the trainers would come in as far as adding in some external stability as best they could to not limit mobility, but allow that extra stability that she may need. And then what I would do is I'd progress through different movements. Is it just standing? Is it a compressive force? And then I'd say, all right, you know, going forward, having to maybe like a forward lunge walk, and to see if her ankle, she overly pronates or supinates based off of that, just off of a slow controlled movement. then progressing through to a lateral movement, you know, stepping over cones and spending some time in that unilateral stance to see if her ankle wants to shift one way or the other, if she feels it, and then slowly increase your speed. And just kind of see if you can narrow down that exact, well, not exact time, but the appropriate time when she starts to notice, okay, my ankle's starting to bother me. That movement bothered me. I felt it in that same spot that it hurts. And then just, you know, really focus on after that mechanics or offering stability where you could via, you know, shoes, ankle straps, tape, those sorts of things.
So would you recommend ankle taping
her
during practice?
And you guys can attest to this better than I can. I mean, how long does taping really last as far as the feedback is there? But I mean, as far as the stability aspect, once they go through that first big cut and they, you know, they move their foot, does the tape actually offer that stability? So I think for feedback purposes, it's probably good. It gives them that support. And anytime you can mentally make a patient or a player feel like they're more supported, they're going to feel less hindered by the movement, and they may be able to move more normally. I would offer them anything that makes them feel better. It's, you know, it's mind over matter sometimes, but if it's just pure pain, then, you know, maybe you have to take a step back and say, all right, is she really appropriate for going back to sports? Maybe just have her in practice until she can get through practice without pain.
Yeah, I think from a, you know, I look at it kind of my background being more in athletic training than the physical therapy side of it. I think dealing with sports, you know, you always have these, your athletes are trying to get back. Most of the time they want to get back and play. Right. Their tendency is going to probably push it a little bit faster than they normally would. And that's where I think that your on-field evaluations or on-court evaluations is very important, is to take that person out and let them run, see how they do, see how they can. You got to kind of figure out what they can do, because the last thing you want to do is put them back in a game and they're really not ready to do that. They make it worse or re-injure or, you know. So I think you want to kind of look at their mechanics and what they're doing on the floor. Now, obviously, there's times that we're going to let, you know, an athlete go back, then they're not 100%. You know, and so there what you're looking at, I think, is truly making sure that they're functional enough to where they don't necessarily hurt themselves again. I think that's the big key to that, is that you got to kind of make sure that you feel like they're stable enough or have enough control or have enough, you know, dealings with their ankle or whatever part you're dealing with, that they can protect themselves and kind of handle it. They may not be quite 100%, but they can, you know, may still be able to function. As far as your, you know, your taping or versus, you know, braces or brace or hard brace, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things on the market now for ankles as far as braces are concerned. Taping is just one venue. You can try taping. I always felt like a pretty good tape job, pretty sturdy tape job was, you know, you could do a lot of things. And you say, yeah, it loosens up. But that proprioceptive, that just, you know, the feeling, you know, it's there. I think that's beneficial. You know, there's a lot of research out that, you know, some people, I think one of the big things is everybody says, well, ankle taping is going to weaken your ankle. I don't really buy that. I don't. And again, I have, you know, there's probably research on both sides. I think that, you know, if you really look at physiology, exercise, and your muscle structures, those muscle structures go much higher than the ankle. They, you know, very few muscles are really right down in the ankle and the foot. So they're all up in the legs. You're exercising those muscles. So to say that it's really weakening the ankle is probably maybe not fair.
Especially if you're training them without the tape away from the game.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of things, that, you know, that you can look at. And, there, you know, we would take braces somewhat through a progression. We would sometimes make a custom ankle brace that was a hard brace that had the, you know, harder stents on the side. You still gave you your flexion, dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, but it limited some of your lateral motion so that you could stabilize the foot a little bit and go from there. And another thing that, you know, when you're talking ankles, and this is something we would use, and again, we're, you know, it kind of depends on what level you're at and how, what you can afford, but we would use orthotics some, you know, and orthotics are not a bad way to help stabilize a foot. If you look at a foot and you know, after an injury and you say, wow, this person really pronates or supinates and this is atypical, the heel's really kicking it, sometimes you can put a wedge or sometimes you can put an orthotic in there that's going to help them.
All right, so Nicole, Brett, have you guys gone over any of this stuff? They're talking about supination and orthotics and yes, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you feel like right now you could look at somebody and tell if they're pronating or supinating, those kind of things?
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
Think so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, I went through the internship program, and honestly, I mean, I know what it is and I could read the book, but it's not something that I do. So, you know, it's good that you guys are being prepared for that, because I don't feel that I was prepared. I've learned through the course of, you know, my 11 years or whatever it is, athletic trainer, but you know, I was just making sure you guys are understanding. Yeah. And
you can assess their shoe, the bottom of the shoe, maybe where there's some more wear wearing down on the shoe. Just kind of like a posterior view on the calcaneus, see if they're more pronated, supinated. Have they had any previous inversion or eversion ankle injuries? I mean, are they knee valgus? There's many ways to assess kind of like the ankle.
So you guys have learned a lot in about, 6 months?
Oh, yeah.
Very good. Good job, Dr. Yell and Dr. Knobloch. So. All right. So, Brett, tell me some of the – not Brett. I just said Brett. Ryan, tell me some of the most advanced ankle rehab stuff that you will do in the clinic.
Well, from my clinic, the way it's set up, I don't have a whole lot of space. So when I have a strictly ankle rehab, late ankle rehab, I'll refer to the trainers back at schools to get them into this late stage, because I have enough room to do some real basic cone drills, hurdles, walking, maybe some sport core type stuff. But I don't have a lane to run. I don't have a lane to see them, you know, do a 5-10-5 or anything like that. So for me, it's gonna be a lot of static support. I want to see that their foot can maintain a neutral position while they're doing some strengthening exercises, while they're balancing. I can do some, you know, some depth jumps and see how they land, some triple hops, lateral hops, counter movement hops, those sort of things, just to see the basics. So before they really go out and run a route, or they, you know, they do horses on the gym and basketball, or they have to, play soccer. I don't get to see that end of it just for my location. But what I make sure is that they can, you know, statically, dynamically, in a controlled environment, move correctly without pain, without rolling. So, you know, any type of strengthening, like I said before, unilateral strengthening, I'll kind of set them up with that way. Do some hurdles, lateral movements, sports cords, have them jump with a sport cord, you know, do a lateral jump and try and land on one foot. And then that external, you know, that external force, that destabilizing torque of the sport cord, trying to pull them off. And then if they can manage to maintain an upright body posture and their foot is not going crazy, or they don't have pain to do it, like,
Nicole.
When Nicole mentioned, as far as knee valgus, watching the knee, just the whole kinetic chain, see if everything's in good alignment, because you can't replicate sport activity in a controlled environment, because you can't prepare for it.
Yeah.
All right. So, whenever I see them do these basic things with my current location, hopefully one day when there's a SMI in Pearland, I can get a little bit deeper look into the more sport specific side of it. But I'll refer out to the trainers, and I'll let the kind of trainers talk on their late in stuff that they do right before you guys return to play.
And I think part of the, you know, in the therapy setting and clinical setting, is you try to do kind of sport specific stuff. In other words, different sports, you know, require different things. So you kind of build your program around those kinds of activities. In other words, if you're going to be doing a lot of hopping, like in basketball, I think basketball coming up right now, you know you're doing a lot of jumping and things like that. So you're going to include those kind of things in your, you know, even in a controlled environment until you get them back out on the court or whatever. I mean, I think that's probably what he's saying is those are the kind of things that he's trying to build up with that athlete before he gets them out into a more of a, you know, so you're working in a little bit more of a controlled environment, opposed to putting them out on a basketball floor where it's kind of helter-skelter and you're not really sure where your forces are coming from. And that's kind of the later stages of your rehab, where you take them out of the clinic and kind of start introducing this. But in a clinical setting, I mean, you can even do your hops and jumps and put resistance against them, or make them balance and start putting forces against them and make them resistant. And, you know, see, we do, I think you're doing a lot of trepidation, or I don't even know how to say the word.
Perturbation,
where you're putting a lot of pressures, different, you know, motions and different things that you're really trying to push them make their body respond. I think something that, you know, I think that you're seeing a lot more of, and a lot of the research is done, is that you're seeing we're adding things in the therapy that, you know, you're trying to make the athlete so that he can't necessarily anticipate what's going to happen. Because that's what happens when you get into athletics, you know, in competition. You don't know where the force is coming from necessarily. So I think that's one of the things that in physical therapy and rehab that we've seen over the last probably 10 years is you're starting to see a lot more of those kind of things. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually, when we're doing some of the TheraBand stuff, I'll kind of like wiggle it. If I'm holding it, you know, I'll wiggle it for him because it's doing what you said, perturbation. I don't even know if I spelled it right in the show notes here, but because it makes it so that it's not just pulling left or pulling right, but like I'm wiggling it left and right or up and down. And so it's including all those other stabilizing muscles and doing those kind of things. But one thing, whenever I was first doing the rehab stuff, we would tell the kids to do the ankle rehab twice a day. But then I'm thinking, if they're lifting weights, they're usually only lifting a muscle group one day and then not the next. And so these kids are coming into the athletic training room in the morning doing ankle rehab, and then they're going to practice for 2 hours, and then I'm trying to tell them, hey, do the ankle rehab again at night. Is that too often? Is that not given a chance to heal? Is that doing more damage?
I think it depends on if you're isolating out the muscles and, you know, the intensity and volume of the activity. I mean, so if you're coming into the training room and doing just isolated ankle exercises and then going out and doing more compound movements in practice and then going home and isolating that again, that could probably be too much. You may want to separate more more active mobility, making sure that they can maintain their mobility versus isolated strengthening. So if they're doing strengthening at school and then they go out and you know, your endurance, your intensity level on the practice field is going to be high. So then at the end of the day, you know, active recovery, ice, stretching, those basic things that aren't going to continue to break down the muscle group, allow for proper recovery. You can probably do something every day, but it doesn't. You don't, just like if you wouldn't want to do a heavy leg day on Monday and then go back and do a heavy leg day on Tuesday. So it all depends on your intensity and your volume of exercise to that specific part. And because it is healing, you probably have to give it a little bit more ample recovery.
This is one of the things we always would fight with athletes on. They say, well, you know, I can't lift every day. Why should I do rehab every day? And I think that you have to look at the intensity of what you're doing. I mean, if you're starting a guy out in rehab, you know, doing straight leg raises, he's probably not getting the muscle function and doing straight leg raises that he would be doing if he's out running around on the field. So, I mean, I think you have to kind of figure out your level of intensity that you're doing. And our comeback would always be, now, wait a minute, you know, if you look at the volume of work, we may be doing a lot of work, but it's not a max capacity most of the time. You're doing more of a functional, you're doing range of motion stuff. It's not, you know, we're not totally exerting you on all these exercises. So I think that's kind of an important thing that you have to kind of think about with your rehab. Now, if they're doing rehab and then going back out on the practice field and doing a full day's practice, then, you know, now you're increasing your intensity, and that is a little different. But, you know, something that, I take back to your basics, don't ever lose control of what you're, you know, how you look at these things. You know, if you have an athlete and, you know, the next day he comes in, you just did a real heavy workout or really workload. Next day he comes in sore as heck and he's swollen and sore. And I mean, hey, we just learned a lesson. We did too much. You know, don't be afraid to look at those things and say, okay, now we need to adjust it back. And, you know, I think that, but make sure it's, don't just make sure you're taking their word for it. In other words, it's killing me today and I can't, you know. Well, let's take a look at it and see, you know, and because sometimes they may say that just so they don't have to do it. So, you know, kind of make them and challenge them a little bit and see where it goes. And sometimes you can push them through and sometimes it's legit and they, you know, you really did overdo it and you need to back it down a day or so.
Nicole, Brett, have y'all had any rehab stuff? Have you been part of rehab yet?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you guys have done as part of rehab?
Well, I'm with the baseball team right now, so a lot of my rehab is with the shoulder, and we also work on hip mobility, making sure that they're getting the hip movement so that they don't put a lot of stress on their elbow or their shoulder. So I've done a lot of shoulder rehab, and also the baseball players that do come in, they may not be coming in for post-injury rehab, a lot of it is maintenance. So being able to keep up with their external rotation or their internal rotation. So we work on that also.
And currently I work with the football team. So right now it's more of just trying to get them put back together to play the next game. So we haven't focused too much on rehab aside from the few cases of ACLs, and we started dealing with them, their post-surgery rehab on strength and knee extension and working with them, but most of those cases are still fresh, so we haven't gotten too in-depth in the whole rehab process yet. So right now, I focus on with dealing with either modality use, trying to help them just calm down any sort of pain levels they have or loosen up and just getting prepared for that to play the next game at their full capacity.
All right. So that's one of the things that I kind of am interested in because, like I said, basketball, they play Tuesday, Friday. So how do I best get them calmed down, like he's saying, but still maintain or strengthen? And you know, that's why sometimes I'll tell the kids, you know, hey, this is one of those things we're going to have to deal with the pain through the season. And then after the season, once we have a chance to rest, then we can, you know, hopefully get past the pain and get it all better. I mean, I don't know if that's correct, but, you know, these kids, they keep going, you know, well, I have to play or I want to play basketball. I want to play. And so then they're going to go play on the weekend if I tell them don't play here. It's a very tough situation. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's hard. I think what you do there is, you know, from an athletic trainer standpoint, I think what you're doing is if they're competing and you're playing twice a week, you know, you can't probably go push them really, really, really hard during those extra days. Because they're still practicing too and things like that. So, you know, what you may have to do is just pick out two or three key exercises that you want to work with them and maybe change those up every day. Just, you know, maybe every day you put a little balance in there. Maybe every day you put a little motion in there. Maybe do a little joint mobs on them. You know, just do some things where you're trying to help loosen them back up, stretch them back out a little bit. And again, you know, you may not even concentrate necessarily on the ankle. You may work on your chain. You may do some stuff with your hips. You may do some balance things where you're including everything. And you're not trying to fatigue the ankle out because you know it's probably already fatigued out. So just kind of use some innovation and kind of look at how can I strengthen this but not wear him out any farther than what we are. And those are the things you have to kind of figure out. And cut back your workload because, you know, I mean, I think that's always one of the things you have to kind of, as you work a guy or an athlete back into practices, you have to kind of back down on some of your workload in the athlete training room because you got to think about, you know, they're getting a lot of that. The things they're doing on the field is a lot of work compared to what they were doing in the training room. So you kind of have to adjust some of your rehab in the training room or in the therapy clinic to what they're doing on the field so that your volume of work is not too much.
I think this is where your peer, your principle of periodization comes in, is knowing your microcycles and mesocycles. So if you're in season, you're not going to be expecting them to go through a strengthening program. It's more recovery, mobility, maintain mechanics, because you know the volume and the intensity of work that they're doing versus on their games and their practices is going to wear them down. So you can't expect them to be able to go in the weight room and get stronger during the season. So, you know, with baseball, you know, you maintain range of motion, you know, posterior cuff mobility. And then, you know, football, it's going to be right now they're playing. So you want to make sure that they haven't lost mobility. If they're hurt, you know, pain is an inhibitor. So you want to make sure that you're activating the muscles that are inhibited by the pain. And then when you get into the postseason and offseason, then it's kind of those, all right, what we can really ramp up, what we, you know, what the issues that we found going through the season. So, you know, pain during season, it's, you know, recover. You know, get better for practice, see if you can maintain, you know, and then like we talked about prior, you know, using whatever orthotics, bracing, taping, modalities, stretching to reduce the pain to allow them to go to their game, allow them to go to practice, and then, you know, just applying the principles of the periodization to allow them to, you know, perform at their best.
Yeah, that's good because I feel like both of you are saying, yes, we're doing correct. We're doing just you reduce the workload, you're just managing. And then once we have time to rest, then we're really working on the work. So good. I don't feel like I'm doing a disservice to my kids. So,
you know, another thing that I think that it totally depends on your philosophy and not just your philosophy, but your coach's philosophy and how they approach these athletes that are injured. I think what you're seeing, though, is that more coaches are realizing that, you know, if you can let, and I think even with football, which is my side where I came from, but any sport where, you know, and let's say basketball right now where you're playing twice a week, you may have to back that athlete down during the week. You may not be able to work him a full practice. You know, you may want to specialize in what he does and certain parts of the practice that he can do. And if your coaches will buy into that, that gives you a little bit of a chance to let that athlete recover a little bit during the week so he's not pounding on that every single day in practice and so on and so forth. And I think you're seeing coaches are adjusting to that a little bit more. But I think that's kind of making, you know, from an athlete trainer therapy standpoint, you know, again, that's kind of where they're going max effort every day. Sometimes you have to back down and figure out where you can back that down a little bit if you want them to keep playing. You know, you run that fine line with an athlete in the sense that, you know, and coaches will say, well, if he can't practice, he can't play. Well, I think that probably depends a little bit on the skill set of the athlete. Some athletes may be able to do that, and some can't. So, but I think what you find from an injury standpoint is if he can't practice, then he's probably going to struggle playing. And, you know, I think what you kind of have to find that mix and who you're dealing with. And, you know, honestly, every athlete's not the same. And you have to, you know, sometimes you have to treat them a little different. And some kids can handle it. Some kids, they just can't, you know. If they don't practice, they don't play very good. Where some guys, you know, they've got the skill set that they're still going to play pretty good. So I think you have to kind of look at it that way. And I know that's from a coaching standpoint, coaches don't like to do that because they want to treat everybody the same. But from an athletics trainer standpoint, trying to get an athlete over an injury, sometimes that's kind of the take that you have to kind of give and take a little bit.
So I know as athletic trainers, we directly deal with the coaches and have to communicate about an athlete who's coming in for rehab. As a physical therapist, Ryan, do you ever directly deal with coaches for athletes that come into your clinic?
In the clinical setting, I'm dealing with parents more than coaches. Parents are coming in saying, all right, I have the next starting quarterback. He tore his ACL. He's got the job next year. I need him ready for camps. I need him ready for this and this. I don't necessarily deal as much with the coaches because I think, you know, as I'm kind of extended away from the school setting in my current location. So they go through the doctors and they go through the trainers. So the trainers and the doctors talk, and then the new guys talk to the coaches. But sometimes I'll have parents who directly communicate with the coaches, and they'll come to me with expectations, putting those on the kid and saying, you need this to happen. They need this to happen so they can.
So more parental.
Yeah, it's more parental. It's more, They're wanting the best for their kids, but right. Sometimes they don't understand the process that needs to be taken to go through it. So, yeah.
All right. So, talk specifically to Nicole here. She's doing baseball shoulder mobility stuff, preventative maintenance kind of thing. So, talk about some of the. Again, we're not talking about the early rehab stuff here, but the stuff that we can do in season or late stage. Rehab type stuff she can do with baseball
and for shoulder.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, during in season, you're looking at mobility with the, especially throwers. I mean, if we want to narrow down to pitchers in particular, who have generally the most, common issues for in season pain is going to be, you know, you're looking at posterior cuff tightness. So it's not necessarily capsular tightness. If they've been throwing, you know, their rotator cuff, particularly teres minor and infraspinatus, you know, that eccentric load that goes into the follow through, slowing down the arm as the arm goes, as you're letting go of the ball.
Deceleration.
Right. So that deceleration is a micro tearing. You know, eccentric loads are what's going to break down the muscle, which allows it to build up stronger. So you think about that concept when you're doing legs and the bigger major muscles. But for smaller muscles like the rotator cuff, that eccentric load tears them down, so then they tense up. So then what you notice is you have a loss of internal rotation versus external rotation. Now, if they've been thrown for long periods of time, you have more external rotation in general. So you'll see somebody with a total arc of motion for rotation being like, you know, 160, when your normal would be 180, but 180 could be different. You may have 110 degrees of extra rotation and only 70 degrees of inter rotation. Well, that's a healthy shoulder for a baseball player, but if you look at somebody who hasn't thrown, maybe they're expecting 90 degrees of motion for inter rotation, so that total arc of motion is what I would really focus on. If they're really limited in internal rotation, you have the GERD syndrome and all those sorts of things. For physical therapists, it was the concept of, you know, the sleeper stretch, really focus on the posterior capsule. I guess some of the research and articles and blogs that I've kind of followed focus more on the cuff itself, the muscles, that they're actually gaining that tension. So instead of focusing on capsular stretching, focus more on crossbody adduction stretching. So genie stretch, arm on top of the other, pull it across. What you don't want to see is that dominant arm, the throwing arm, the external rotation come in. So you kind of lock it down and pull across and lock down the scapula. So you get true stretch to the posterior cuff. You can do that either manually, or you can do that laying on the side of a table, kind of locking down that scapula. And that's what's going to regain that internal rotation, because you've lost it via the muscular tension, that muscular breakdown versus the capsular tightness. So, and then in strength in general, they're throwing, so they don't need a lot of strengthening. You don't want to put them in the rate room, but kind of like what you mentioned, kind of keeping those rotator cuff muscles turned on, and not necessarily isolated. So I wouldn't do a lot of rotation stuff. For me, I do more stability, so I do a lot of carries. Mm-hmm. Farmers carries, waiter carries, get a kettlebell, turn it upside down, so a bottoms up kettlebell in a scapular plane. Mm-hmm. It's the rotator cuff's job is not necessarily to rotate the arm, but right, to stabilize the glenohumeral head, the joint. So keeping those muscles turned on, firing in their functional manner to keep that head in the socket, so there's a center, rotation versus that instability when you have a rotator cuff that's not firing appropriately. So in season, it's just about maintaining normal functional movement, normal functional activation. And then when off season comes around, kind of narrowing down their issues, regaining normal function, and then building up a better base so they can tolerate the full season of activity.
All right. So in some of the carries, we talked about the visual cues. Tell me what you're looking for with a farmer's carry or whatever you just called this thing.
Waiter.
A waiter carry. Oh, yeah, like a waiter. Okay, yeah. I got it.
Well, I mean, if you're throwing, you want your shoulder blade and you want your arm in proper alignment. Your scapula and your GH joint should move in coordinated motion. If you have a forward scapula, tilted scapula, you're going to have an internally rotated position, so you're going to lack that ability to really retract and get back here. So with the waiter's carry, if you're going to be in full 90 degrees abduction, I really have them pack the shoulders back. Full retraction of the scapula allows them to get into an adducted position. So if you think about throwing, right, when they're coming through, a lot of elbow stress comes when they lead with their elbow, mm-hmm. right? So they've lost that ability to retract. So if they come through and their acceleration action is more elbow related versus if they can retract through the shoulder blade, have proper T-spine mobility, they're now keeping their arm in line with the scapula, which then keeps that rotator cuff in its dominant position, so it's not disadvantaged. So really working on that endurance to be able to hold that position. And if you have the kettlebell upside down, there's a perturbation aspect of the kettlebell wanting to fall off. So you have grip strength, you have that irradiation. So the harder you squeeze here, the more it's going to fire closer to the shoulder. And then just have them walk. And it's pretty amazing, just a 15-pound upside down kettlebell, how it fatigues them out because they're holding mm-hmm. it in that position. Versus a farmer's carry where it's down below, it's a heavier weight, it's more of a trunk control, it's more shoulder blades. If you can... that's just more of a strengthening thing. I wouldn't necessarily do that for a thrower right off the bat, but that's just a way to kind of work on grip strength, work on postural control, core control, keeping an upright posture, not letting that weight kind of sag you down. So those are some of the basic things.
What about the Turkish getup?
Turkish getup's great. I think it's a great active warm-up, or it could be a strengthening exercise, but it's the same concept of holding that kettlebell. Turn the kettlebell upside down, drop it down, and have them focus on keeping that kettlebell pointing up. Mm-hmm. While they're doing that, because it's a perturbation to the shoulder as they're moving around. And then, a heavier kettlebell, just let it rest there, but it's a good grip strength thing. I love the Turkish get-up for all my guys. My ACL's all the way up to my shoulders.
All right, I think you talked about that, and I think that's in your PowerPoint, right?
No.
Because
it's not a video. I talked about it, but it's actually, it was one of the, was it the, I can't remember, maybe the number one core exercise that involved all the muscle groups.
Yeah, that's what it was. Because the first time I'd heard it was this summer, Turkish get-up, and so I don't really remember.
It's big in the strength and conditioning community. It's not so much a rehab exercise, but, you know, I think that's why some of my athletes enjoy coming to my clinic, is that I incorporate these exercises. If they haven't seen them before, it's not the same old stuff that they've done through junior high and high school. They actually are getting challenged in different ways, and if I can explain it to them why this is beneficial, they'll really buy in and do the exercises, and they get the full carryover of it. So it's something that they haven't done in rehab before, so they appreciate something new and challenging, like we mentioned before.
Keeps them motivated.
Yeah, so that's the thing I'm trying to work through, is you go through the progressions. You say, hey, we're doing, this is our goal. We're going to do a 5-minute run today. If that's good, then we're going to go to a 10-minute run tomorrow. If that's good, then we're going to start doing left and right jogging, or, you know, S things with the ankle. And so, you know, like you're talking about going through progressions, and then what I'm really looking for is a way to challenge them to keep coming, to get stronger, so that it's not the same, just, okay, we'll come in and just do your TheraBand exercises and your calf raises and go back out to practice, and you're going to just be hurt. So, you know, those are the things I need to figure out how I can move them past that and just do my job better. So I think I'm going to have to go to the weight room and try the waiter carry and the farmer walk. How long do you normally, like, do you have like a 2-minute waiter carry, or what is the typical?
Get creative as you want. I mean, honestly, if it's an endurance athlete, you know, a pitcher, starter, the more endurance, the better, right? You know, if they lose their ability to maintain arm slot, then you're going to see them drop in accuracy and volume, not volume, but velocity. So, you know, for a guy, it wouldn't be a heavier weight, but it'd be more of endurance versus, a lineman, somebody who's going to have, 5 to 6 seconds of action and then it stops. Well, then it could be something heavier for a shorter distance. I mean, it just, you know, the said principle comes into play there, right? So specifically what they actually do on the field, you want to tailor your exercise to that time. So no sense in having a lineman go run, you know, a mile, right? Whenever he needs to work on explosive type activity. Same with the baseball pitcher. You know, this goes against some of the coaches nowadays, but why does a starting pitcher need to be able to jog around the baseball field? I don't know where endurance comes into play when they have 3 to 5 seconds of action. There's carryover for sure, but, you know, if you're going to tailor your exercises, try and make it so that, you know, it best carries over to that specific position or specific function that you're looking for. So I think the standard is about 20 yards of carry. And then strength standards for guys, I think, is body weight plus on a farmer's walk. Women, probably something smaller than that. But I mean, if you can carry your body weight and dumbbells for 20 yards there and back, maintain a good form and technique, afterwards you feel like your arms kind of want to float off your side, right? Because the isometric contraction, that time under tension, those muscles are constantly contracting. So it gives them a good workout. I usually use it as a finisher, because you're going to wear out your grip, you're going to wear out your endurance, you're going to fatigue them. It's kind of like, you know, isometric holds. You don't want to try and do something challenging dynamically after you fatigued them out. So definitely a finisher from my point of view.
All right. So Adrian Peterson, right?
Okay.
So what, 6 months rehab? So we actually had a guy that during spring football tore his ACL. Okay. 5 months later, we returned him to play. So it's kind of a special situation. This was the last game. He's a senior, probably no college play, and so it's just kind of a, hey, you understand the risk, we're gonna put you back in there just for this one game, you may play only one play, you know, depending on how you feel, that kind of thing. He played most of the game, did well, no problems. You know, he came in and he worked, but how can we, obviously we're not going to make everybody return in 6 months, but what are some of the things you talked about, the Turkish get up for ACL, and again, I'm gonna have to YouTube it and find out what it is. But what are some of the late stage exercises besides playing the Xbox for ACL rehab?
For me with ACLs, and actually, Bubba Wilson and I are working on a criteria based protocol, working with the guys out in TMC as well. But Bob Wilson, the athletic trainer for the Southeast region, Memorial Hermann. basically, if you can do something and you're passing these criteria, we can move on to the next phase. And so this gentleman who played at 5 months, he probably had a really good baseline of strength that allowed him to kind of quickly move through some of those earlier phases. And so, you know, later stage stuff really has to kind of be dependent on, you know, what their goals are. Some of my, let's just stick with athletes, sports specific. Okay. So, jumpers, if they're a big tall guy who's going to play underneath the basket, you want to make sure that they have proper landing mechanics. All right. But go back from that. You got to look at, all right, in order to get up into the jump and regain their vertical, you have to look at the muscles that are highly involved in a vertical jump. And so, your quads, your glutes, you know, dominant muscle groups that do that. Also core type stuff. You know, if you're playing under the basket and you're getting elbowed and you're having to move and you're having to maintain position, core stability, anti-movement core exercises was what that presentation mm-hmm. that we talked about last time that should be on there deals with, is resisting destabilizing torques in different directions. So your core should be able to, you know, keep you from moving versus core strengthening, which would be more like the abs, crunches, and Russian twists, which is an isolated action, whereas the core kind of works as one giant unit to keep you from moving. So I do a lot of unilateral stuff, unilateral leg exercises in all different directions. I throw in, rotation, anti-rotation type stuff where they have to keep themselves from moving out of a position while they're in single leg stuff. I really push their strengthening in their earlier phases, glutes, hamstrings, and quads. And then once they're appropriate, they have appropriate strength and appropriate stability, we'll progress into plyometrics and jumping and landing prior to doing their on-the-field drills.
I think what you've seen, and I've seen it here since I've been here, and I think what we're seeing with our physical therapists and our physicians and in a lot of our clinics is what we're seeing today is, I think we're seeing, and he was touching on a little bit, they're establishing some protocols and some benchmarks that these athletes have to hit before they move to the next level. I think what you're seeing in therapy is that, you know, and what he was discussing about trying to set up some parameters, they're trying to set up kind of a framework of, okay, we're going to make everybody kind of go through this progression. And you have to, these are the marks that you have to hit before you advance to that next progression. So it gives you kind of a systematic approach to this. And it's one that you can reproduce with, you know, most of your athletes. That doesn't mean everybody's going to do it the same. And I think it takes, you know, it's easy to say, okay, in 20 weeks, you're going to be here. Well, if you're not there, we need to have something that says, hey, look, you're not really ready to move on yet. I know it's 20 weeks or 10 weeks or 5 weeks or whatever that time is, whatever that benchmark you're shooting for at 20 at that point. But I think that's what you're starting to see. And I think a lot of the orthopedic surgeons and the rehab people, and they're kind of putting through these parameters. And I think what you see then is you see, and you say, well, why do some athletes go much faster than others? Well, you know what? There's a whole lot of factors involved in that. There's pain. There's the ability to fight through that discomfort. There's, you know, just somebody may have a tendency to swell more, and they don't, you know, they just can't function quite as well. They can't operate through something, so it takes them a longer time to get back. Your question about Adrian Peterson is, Adrian Peterson is a remarkable professional athlete. Maybe a one, you know, God knows how many, what percentage he is on the scale. There's not many people like him. So, you know, how many people can, it probably didn't really matter. And I say this, it probably didn't really matter what his rehab was. He was going to do pretty good. Mm-hmm. As long as he had a stable knee and could function, he was athletic enough that he could probably take about any challenge he was able to get through it. There's not very many of those out there, though, and that's where the therapists and hitting those benchmarks and so on and so forth are. But I think it's important that you don't, you know, I always felt like we were too aggressive on ACLs. I think that we would put guys back when they really weren't ready to go back. But I think it also depends on what level they're having to play at. Being from the NFL, I was very reluctant to put a player back before I really thought he was really there, depending on, despite how much time he had. Because if he, at that level, everything that you do is so precise, and it depends on whether your job, you make your job or not, on whether you can function. So if you slow down, you know, run a 4.4 or a 4.8 instead of a 4.3 or 4.4, that's a big thing for you. So those are the things that you have to kind of make up and make sure that they're ready to do that. So it depends on what level you're at as to how much you can give and take. And going back to your high school athletes, you know, that, and you say, well, you know, were we okay to let him play? I think that's where you go back to your physician that did the surgery. And he does his protocols, and he goes back and says, does he meet these benchmarks? And is he safe? Are we safe enough to let him go play? Because he's shown us he can do these things. He's safe to go out there and play in a limited capacity, possibly, without re-hurting his knee. And if everybody feels like that, then it, you know, and you feel comfortable letting him go back and do that, then that 5-6 months is probably okay as long as he fits those benchmarks. But if he doesn't, then it's not a good idea to let him go back there and play. And, you know, the chances of re-injury are much higher if he's not able to do the things that, you know, you really think and know that he's got to be able to do. He may not be 100%, but he may, as long as he can do those things and be safe about doing them, that's where you. But I think a lot of your re-injuries are guys that they just haven't hit those marks, and we get them out there too fast and then re-injure because we'll re-injure something else because they're still having to adapt and not able to control it.
I think the hard part is finding that standard basic criterion that everybody's going to agree on. You're going to have coaches who push harder. You're going to have doctors who want you to go slower and more conservative. So having that standard basic criterion that says at this point, regardless of time and weeks, you should be able to perform these activities before you go on to the next phase. I think that's going to be the hardest challenge for healthcare in general, is everybody agreeing on one topic. You have, you know, years of experience and anecdotal evidence to say, you know, I'm sure Brad came across it where, you know, 6 months out, they should be ready to play versus a guy who maybe says, no, I see people go back without injury at 8 months. And that's my goal. That's what I want to get them back to. And then you have, you know, like we talked about before, parents and other coaches who are pushing because maybe they had an earlier injury and they have their next level dependent on if they meet this camp or if they go to this, school visit. And so they really, really push. And then individually, kids who are motivated are going to tend to, like we talked about, push through a little bit more if they have an end goal in sight. So your 5 month guy who played obviously had a goal in mind, and he pushed through probably some of the discomfort that other people may have said, you know what, I'm going to hold back on that. So ACL rehab in general, I don't think there's one good way to do it. I think is the big thing we're trying to accomplish with this protocol is just to get everybody on the same page so that we can come up with a standard basic criteria, and then that way, you know, on your side of things, you did your best and you put that kid back in their position, the safest position possible. And then if something happens, it's out of your hands. Not that it's not your fault and it's not the kid's fault, but there, you know, on your side of you did your job. So
when can we expect the benchmarks or the protocols that you guys are working on? You have a ETA for that?
Well, we're going to Med Center to talk with one of the main docs and talk with his crew to kind of give them the rough draft, and we're meeting with the research department and getting with them. They have their own evidence-based outcome measures that we're looking to implement into this protocol as well, to say, all right, you know, if research and studies show that these are outcomes that demonstrate, you know, you've met this this strength, or, you know, a percentage of strength is shown to be appropriate for the next phase, you know, we want to implement that and have as much evidence backing this protocol as possible. You know, medicine nowadays, evidence practice, you want to make sure that you have that backing you so that you have, you know, less controversy about it. But we're hoping to speak at the next sports medicine update on it. Maybe not have it out running, but you know, bring it out to the trainers and therapists in the area and community, and basically present on it. So I think that's our next big landmark as far as pulling it out. I think it's still a work in progress. Many heads working together to kind of put their input into it. So,
and I think another thing that's important here to kind of keep in mind, and run a test of this possibly, is, you know, I don't think there's ever a right or necessarily, I shouldn't say never a right or wrong way. There's a lot of ways to do the rehab. There's a lot of different exercises that you can throw into the rehab, and you never can lose your perspective of, you know, you're always looking to see what happens as a result of an exercise. You add an exercise, what happens, what's the result of that exercise, how they do. So never lose your assessment part of that rehab as to how far to advance them. I think what they're trying to come up with, and you may be able to help me here, is I know some of the orthopedic surgeons that we deal with are kind of have a certain test that they go through or want an athlete to be able to perform to say whether they feel like he's ready to go in and go back to sport. So how you get to that point, I think there's a lot of variation. I think what part of the end result is kind of looking at a certain type of parameter or test that you can put this athlete through that, and if he can do that successfully, you feel pretty comfortable letting him go back on the field. And you may be able to, do you understand what that's a, and I'm not totally familiar with exactly what those tests are. I just know, I've heard that you guys are kind of working on a few of those things like that.
Right. The problem, I'm not going to say the problem, but the current landscape is a you know, post-op week determination. Mm-hmm. How many weeks post-op are you to let you go on to the next phase? And, you know, like Brad mentioned, you know, you're going to have different baselines going into surgery, where Adrian Peterson could probably outperform us 3 weeks out of surgery on certain activities versus people who can do, you know, have to wait 2 months. So what the problem is when you have a student or a parent or a coach that says he is 16 weeks out, and on this protocol that you've given us, it says he should be able to return to this, but that student may not have been able to get a full knee extension and quad activation for another, you know, for 12 weeks because of swelling or pain or something. So the time-based protocol was becoming worked against itself, and that you had people not meeting those expectations, and so then you had somebody who's behind or ahead, and then you say, well, you're doing too well, let's slow down. Where if somebody's doing well, you don't want to slow them down, you want to continue to challenge them. But there, you know, there are certain biological factors that you can't rush: healing time, tissue healing, obviously concomitant injuries, meniscal, you know osteochondral deficits, those sorts of things you have to work around. So these tests, these measures we're trying to put out are going to hopefully demonstrate to everybody involved in the care, the coaches, the trainers, therapists, the doctors, the injury, the athlete themselves, that once they can meet these objective measures, that's shown through research, through time, through, you know, evidence, all right, you can now perform this, we can now move on to this next phase. You are showing us that you are safe to continue. And I think takes some stress off the therapist, but it also takes some stress off the students and athletes in general.
So. All right. Okay, so one of the things that I'm looking to do is functional movement testing. So she was talking about, you know, we've been talking about kinetic chain and mobility. Do you do any sort of functional movement testing? Have you heard of FMS, the functional movement screen?
Yep.
What are your thoughts on that? Because I think we're going to try and implement that here because it's a good preventative measure. And I'm not saying it's perfect or the best system, but I think it's something that we can do and manage here.
Yeah, I think it's a great tool to have in your toolbox. I don't think it's a you know, be-all, end-all assessment. It falls nicely into a split lane we're talking about with rehab and phases. It falls right into that kind of functional symmetrical phase where if you have a knee injury or an ankle injury, a shoulder injury, whatever motions you go through on the uninvolved side, you should be able to replicate on the involved side. So functional movement assessments make sure that your symmetrical mobility. So it kind of unearths underlying immobilities, weaknesses, strengths, to allow you to address prior to that next phase. So if, you know, if their next phase involves heavier weights or more dynamic motion, and you go through the FMS and you can see that, you know, they don't have, you know, a proper squat, they don't have the ankle mobility to allow them to go into a deep overhead squat, but you in the next phase are going to put them into a resistance training program that involves that deep squat, you're going to lead yourself to, you know, further injury somewhere else. You know, compensations or you know, the back's going to end up going through extra mobility that a hip can't go through. So, I mean, I think it's a great toolbox to have. I think it's a great assessment to utilize prior to different phases. I don't currently do the entire thing only because I haven't been educated properly on it. I'm hoping to get that done. And I think our idea is to get most of our therapists within the system, especially at the institutes, doing that. It's just another research-based assessment. How about you guys as trainers in the school setting? Do you guys
Yeah, we're familiar with the FMS. We're learning the different tests that you would do for functional movement screening, such as 90-90 overhead squat, world's greatest stretch. We do learn them. We haven't applied them to any of the athletes. Well, at least I haven't.
We work with basketball a little bit just to run through it.
Yeah, for the knee valgus. But yeah, we're familiar with them.
I think you're looking at it in a couple of different settings. I think from a physical therapy setting and a clinical setting, it's a very good tool because you do the screen and then you address the deficiency or the problem. I think when you're in a school setting, it's a little different because, and it's different how you use that screen. Because if you do the functional movement screen on every one of your athletes or everyone on your football team, now what are you going to do with those results? In other words, now you say in an athletic training, and this athlete may not have an injury. You may have just done it on everybody just to see what their weakness or their problem was. Now you, as the person that did that screening, it doesn't do you a lot of good unless you institute the fix or try to address the situation. So I think that, you know, there's a couple of ways to look at it, and I think that you've seen a lot of strength and conditioning people, and you know it sounds great. And it's a good skill, and it's a good assessment. But if you don't fix the assessment, or what came out of the assessment, if you're not able to spend the time with each of your athletes to do that, then it was not really probably very worth its time. So I think it depends on how you want to use it, and how what your time is to use it, and how much you can, you know, really adapt individually, because it's an individual test. It's not a team test. So everybody that you do, you know, there's an assessment on every guy or every girl. So you have to kind of take that test and say, okay, this is what your deficiency is, or this is where what the functional movement screen showed your, you know, motions here or this. So now we have to address that with you. So how are you going to do that? And so I think that's part of that functional movement screen. How you use it, where you use it, there's probably a lot of advantages to it if it's used correctly. And there's a lot of times that I think it's probably done and then not really utilized to its fullest because of time restraints or the athlete not just doing it, or, you know, you might be able to show him, but if they don't carry it out, then it, you know, so you might do it again in 2 weeks and still, you know, it hadn't changed. So I think the functional movement screen is a great toolbox, and in the right setting, it can be very useful, and it's a great assessment tool, but it's not going to be used all the time.
I think a good example, like you said, if you do it at the very beginning of maybe the like preseason, is to utilize that almost like it's a concussion baseline. So if they do get injured or they do sprain their ankle, you have something to say, you scored this pre-injury, preseason before you had worn down. Let's get you back to that baseline before we can say, use that as one of the baseline assessments to say, all right, that fall, you can perform like you did prior to being injured, along with all the other, test that you need to do to get back on the field. So it's like I said, it's a tool, something to be utilized in the gamut of, you know, return to play or, you know, preseason. We see these issues, let's address these issues prior to, you know, moving on. So I think it can be used all kinds of ways.
Yeah, I mean, that's our plan would be if we get the training, then we'd kind of assess them after a season so that we can implement some exercises during their off-season training to improve hip mobility for the, you know, the linemen that are doing squats but they can't bend all the way down or those kind of things. And then as we get better at it, then be able to do it before the season for things to work on, for them to work on during, and then after the season for things to work on during the off season. So that kind of thing, that's our plan, you know, implementing that with, you know, 600 kids or whatever it is that we have with two athletic trainers may be a lot more difficult than I think. But it's just one of those things where we're trying to be better, and I think that's going to help us prevent injuries, which is a large part of what we do as athletic trainers. So, Brad, I want to go back to, we were talking about ACLs, and we're talking about rest. And so you got to have a guy that has an ACL tear, returns to play. What are some of the exercises you're going to do with him in the athletic training room to maintain or to prevent further? So, you know, he's already gone back to play. He's going to come back into the athletic training room besides maybe ice. What's some of the stuff that you're going to do with him?
I think you have to kind of assess what his symptoms are and what his issue is. If you feel like he's just not quite there yet as far as his strength is concerned, you're still going to kind of work in some strength exercises into his program. If it's more of his reaction and speed, then you're going to work on, you know, you want to kind of isolate on what, I guess I would call it a lot of your finishing touches. You got to be able to kind of do some of your finishing touches. But I also look at, I guess I was a pretty firm believer, and once they were really out on the field, that was great rehab. I didn't necessarily, you know, if they were still kind of going through the progression of practicing and kind of working in, then we would, you know, still isolate a lot more on rehab. But as they were starting to work back into full practice and they were, you know, if we would return them back to playing in games, that's a great rehab right there. I mean, you can't simulate a practice or game situation. Speed, you know, quickness, the things that they have to do without thought. You know, I mean, I guess that's the thing that we all, you know, it's so hard in rehab is to come up with something that, where they can't really think how they're going to respond because they just have to respond. And so I think it depends on what, you know, kind of where you are in that finishing stages. And then you look at each guy and say, okay, where is he kind of deficient or what do we need to kind of work on? And do, again, I emphasize, I think that you have to kind of really cut back on it. I mean, you can't do a full rehab with a guy that's playing all the time. So you're going to have to isolate down on a couple of exercises where you may do a combination. I think one of the best things that the kettlebells is a great functional exercise now. I mean, I think that's really come around, and because it involves so many different things. You can get so many different joints involved in that exercise, and it's a great combination exercise. So things like that, you know, you find a couple exercises like that you can really hone in on that you think is going to help you. And you may, you know, don't necessarily do the same exercise every day. Maybe pick two or three exercises every day, different exercises that kind of works a little different part or something else that you want to emphasize, and then kind of work them back. And again, I always say you got to really watch them in practice and see what they're doing. And I think you have to have a very realistic approach when you put a guy back into practice, and you know, you really want to watch him and see what he can and can't do and see what positions he's in. And you know, you can't go be afraid. My experience was you couldn't just throw a guy out there and say, okay, no, you're ready to go do it. You had to watch him and see where he was deficient and see what things he could do and couldn't do very well, and then kind of concentrate on those things and try to help him get through that part of it.
All right, so you said pick a few exercises out. So just say, you know, football player, Brett's working with football, trying to maintain, they have some guys with ACLs. So tell me just, again, off the top of your head, a schedule of, you know, something you would do on Monday, something you would do on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, that kind of thing for one of your football players.
I think you probably work a little balance, you know, kind of work your hip stuff, your core stuff. I think you never can forget your core. It's so important. You kind of work, and Ron can kind of attest to some of this. You know, one day you may work a little bit more. We would a lot of times work more of a real heavy day or a strength day, and then more of a function day. In other words, more of a balance, more of a reaction, more of a step and balance, or your lunges and, you know, reaction drills where you're having to catch the ball in a certain position, and, you know, one-legged stuff and things like that. Whereas the other day you may work more on just pretty much a pure strength day, maybe working some lunges and squats and, you know, kind of isolating down the just the strength part of it, kind of more the old-fashioned just strengthening. And then, you know, you may take the third day and say, okay, well, we're practicing. We're just back off completely. We won't do anything. You know, another thing we would, again, kind of take, we'd just kind of take endurance exercises like you know, the old squat thrusts and jumping jacks and just a kind of a conglomerate of exercises that we would put kind of, we'd call it a kind of a ladder of exercises, and they would, you know, we had like maybe 10 exercises, and, you know, you might do 20 jumping jacks, and then you might do 20 squat thrusts, and then you might do a little kettlebell work, you know, with a dumbbell or something. And then you could, I mean, just a variety of exercises that makes the whole body work, and do that for about a 2-minute period of time where you're working a pretty intense period and then rest. And you might go through that 2 or 3 times just to change it up, just to do something different. I think that one of the hardest things about a long-term rehab is people get bored because the exercises are, you know, it's hard to find a bunch of different exercises. So, and you really have to concentrate on certain things. So you kind of, you know, those exercises kind of get, you know, honed in on that. This is what you work at. And then, you know, it's time to move on to the next, but it's very boring. So you got to, you know, every once in a while, I'd always say, you know, you just try to find some things to change it up where you're still getting something out of it. But it may not be just that very same exercise. So again, you make it a little competitive. You may make it, you may do something that's a little different. You may just, you know, but again, you're making them do. There's a system now that, you know, you can do a leg press or a leg exercise against a ski slope. There's a picture of the ski slope on the computer, and you're skiing down the mountain, and you have to adjust your leg pressure, make yourself go down the ski slope. Or drive a race car with your legs, you know, it just makes you adjust. And I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, you're talking about your, what do you do with your boards and stuff. I mean, there's all kinds of games, and the more competitive or game friendly it is, you can adapt those into your rehab, and it changes it up. And you're not going to do that every day. But if you, you know, I mean, just gives you some variety.
All right. Hopefully you can take that back, yeah, and use that with some of your guys there. So, all right, it's about that time. You guys have any final questions before I close it out? Questions come in.
I guess my question to these two going to school is, what do they need to know? What do they want to know from us that they, you know, maybe at the top of their head, or something that they haven't seen, or maybe something you've seen that you didn't quite understand why you approached it that way, or, you know, if there's anything out there like that.
I guess take it back to your, prevention. When we were talking about biofeedback earlier about ankle injuries, I had a question like, would it be, I guess, wise to look into having athletic trainers start training their athletes just to have like, you're standing on like one of the foam pads, close their eyes, just to get more spatial awareness of the athletes, like how their ankle works, just so, like, when they're actually playing, once you remove that loss of vision, they have an increased amount of sensory input where you can actually sort of prevent, like, they can sense, like, if an ankle's about to sprain, they know that feeling of it's getting close to their limitations and counteract that and prevent it. Would that be wise, or like even worth trying to attempt in like time consuming or effort wise in like a mass training for your athletes in like a school program for high school, just to make them more aware of like how their limbs move in space and just get a better understanding of themselves?
I think what you're saying with some and Ryan could probably attest to this a little bit more. I think what you're seeing a lot of your strength training programs is that you're starting to see a little bit more of that variation, that very thing. You're starting to see a lot more functional things happen in a weight room. You know, a lot of the weight rooms now, a lot of strength coaches today, they don't do the typical, just all the Olympic lifts anymore. There's a lot of different things. There's a lot of the kettlebell stuff, the ropes, the lifts, the dumbbells, the Indian clubs. I always laugh because, you know, we've gone back 50 years to the stuff that we did 50 years ago. You know, some of those things, but they're just good exercises. They're all around. They make the whole body function. You're working, you know, we always talk about chain. You're working the whole chain with some of these exercises. Everything has to contract and function. And I think that's a great example. I think you make them balance. You make them, you know, you hold a kettlebell on one leg and have to do a certain thing. Then you're engaging a lot of different aspects of the body to make it function. You know, I think that maybe a better way to look at that is I think, you know, one of the big issues over the years has been, why do women tear their ACLs more than men? And what's the preventative thing there? And I think you're starting to see, you know, a lot of people are looking at that and saying, okay, we've got to teach them how to land and how to jump properly and land properly and things like that. And I think that with the result of that, you're seeing some improvement there. In other words, you may not, that has maybe decreased a little bit. But I think it's just, again, I think it's that, you know, kind of learning that proprioceptive training, you know, your awareness. And I always laugh because it's, you know, just because you're a great athlete doesn't mean you have great proprioception. And I've seen some guys that can really do a lot of things, and they can't stand on one foot without falling over. But you can teach it. I mean, it is something you can learn, and it's something that, you know, makes them a better athlete if they can. So, again, that's part of your screening, part of your awareness of where they are and how you can help them. So I think that, you know, I think as you're seeing a lot more of your evidence-based medicine, you're seeing a lot of the research that's been done with a lot of these things. We may take a little different approach to this over the next 10 years as a lot of this stuff kind of is created and you see some of this research that's happened and say, okay, how can we do it? And then at the same time, you know, I always say don't throw out the, you know, the baby with the bathwater. Remember what you've done in the past, what's worked for you. You know, Ryan has some exercise he loves to do, and he knows what the outcome of it is, and he knows it really. And I have some exercise that I would do, you know. And so you don't have to necessarily recreate the whole rehab process every time. Try to get consistent so you can get some consistency in how you do it. And then you kind of know. If you change every single time you do an ACL, you're never going to know what really worked, because there's so many variables. That, you know, if you do it six totally different ways, and one guy, you know, maybe it's because he was an Adrian Peterson, you know, that he did so well, and you think, oh, man, I was a great athletic trainer. I was a great therapist because I got this guy back in six. Well, maybe that had more to do with the guy. So, you know, you got to try to get some consistency in what you're doing and look at it, and then look at it and say, okay, wow, that didn't work very good. We need to maybe change that up.
I'd also, you know, I like that. Don't try and reinvent the wheel. You know, there's all kinds of new exercise equipment, things that are coming out. I mean, you look at the shake weight, you know, something silly like that where they, you know, you have some people say, well, this is a great way to, you know, do this or that, you know, body blades, Bosu balls. I mean, for me, you know, why would you need to do a full squat with dumbbells on a Bosu ball unless you're going to participate in the Bosu Olympics? I mean, it doesn't really have a lot of carryover. So if you have late stage type stuff, you know, on the field, you know, I always go back to the said principle, and I said it before, you know, what do they specifically do on the field that imposes demands on their body, and how can you best get them to practice that movement over and over? If it's a stop, decelerate, and change direction, you know, If it's a you know, jumping up and landing and then going right back up, if it's an ankle, if it's a knee where they have valgus issues, you know, standing, stopping, cutting, you know, it's those are the type of things where, you know, you can go through all your rehabs, you can stand them and close their eyes, and that's great, and that shows that they have good proprioception. But when they're on the field, does standing still with your eyes closed ever come into play? You know, does standing on a Bosu ball or an unstable surface, throwing a ball against a trampoline, ever come into play? So, you know, it's part of the rehab, but then also don't try and say, all right, we're going to stand on this and we're going to throw a ball at you and I need you to count backwards from 10. You know, you could throw too much at them at the same time as trying to get them to really focus on different things. So, you know, like Brad said, you know, find out what works for you and what you see is improved, their outcomes, and then stick with it and adapt with it and base it off of the patient, base it off the athlete. But yeah, really kind of trying to tailor your activities to what they need to be able to replicate, especially with our athletes.
All right. Yeah, so we just recently required all athletes to do rehab before they would get taped. So anybody that's getting taped, unless it's like an immediate injury and they're in the game or something, they have to come in and do, you know, TheraBand exercise, balancing and calf raises and stretching, stuff like that, because we're getting in the habit of, this is the routine of exercise we're going to do to prevent. And so it's kind of the same thing. We're just getting them used to it, getting them in the routine. And it's not just, hey, let's put tape on it to fix it, but hey, let's do exercises to strengthen it. And so I think that concept, it's still the same exercises, but we're just implementing it in a different way. We're adapting it. So I think I'm definitely going to look into saying, okay, on Mondays we're doing this, or, you know, we have two sets of routines for, you know, rehab, and that way, right, this day and this day. And so I'm looking forward to seeing the benchmarks for some of these return to plays and how we can incorporate those. But pretty cool. I think I've learned a good bit. You guys had some really good questions. I know we didn't get to everything I had listed in the notes, but that's all right. While you're here, Ryan, thank you for being willing to come and talk about the biofeedback units that we didn't get to talk about today. But you're actually a big part of your willingness to come out to be part of that. And I'm sure at some point you'll come back, but your willingness to be part of that is a large reason why we got that grant that got each of our five high schools two biofeedback units. So it was a $5,000 grant for biofeedback units so that we can teach our sports medicine students. You know, if Bob wants to be a physical therapist, well, now he has an experience with biofeedback as well as, you know, a personal conversation with a physical therapist on how to use it. He's a lot further along than a kid that's never been in a physical therapy clinic.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to have helped in any way I could.
So just even throwing your name to the mix helps out, you know, because you're willing to give your time. So thank you for being that. Brad, thank you for coming back again. Nicole and Brett, I'm glad y'all were able to come without adult supervision this time. again, Dr. Knobloch and Yellen are really doing a good job of educating them. And I'm really impressed with what you guys know, just being 6 months into athletic training. And so it's really cool to learn from you guys as well, because you throw out words that I don't know. If you want to earn CEUs for listening to the broadcast, you have to listen to the live one. So you can't get it for listening to the recorded one unless I can find a donor with some deep pockets that wants to pay the $50 for every episode to be approved as a home study. Then you just have to listen to the live one to get the CEUs, which are sponsored by GHATS, the Greater Houston Athletic Trainer Society. Our website has all the information that you need to register or about the links. And right now I'm a little behind because of the newborn baby, so everything's a little bit crazy, but it'll eventually get caught up and smoothed back out. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Almost every single Wednesday we're live, and usually it's 11 to 12:30, but sometimes it changes a slight bit. Twitter, I'm on Twitter at PHS Sports Med. I'm on Google+ at Sports Medicine Broadcast. Facebook.com/PHS Athletic Training. So for Jeremy, the Sports Medicine 1 class that left like an hour ago, that's a wrap.